You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert Kent, the editor-in-chief, and I'm here with...
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And Susie Evans, senior editor.
And we have an exciting April issue that we're putting out, the Broadway package, all about Broadway, putting out the package online this week. You'll see that as part on this podcast. We'll talk about that package and some of the amazing stories in this great Broadway season. And we'll explain why we're writing about Broadway at a nonprofit theater institution.
Though some people ask us, why don't we write about Broadway?
Right, exactly. Well, we'll explain all that. And then we'll also talk about... the National Endowment for the Arts, under threat in a new way, or just business as usual. We'll talk about that. And then we have an interview with...
Martin Zimmerman. He is making his New York debut this season. He's a Chicago-based playwright. He's been producer around the country, but now he's finally going to come to New York with two productions.
Two productions?
Yeah.
Wow.
So
he's at the Underground, right?
Yeah, Roundabout Underground on the Exhale with Marin Ireland. It's a one-woman play. And with Seven Spots in the Sun at Rylestick, which I will give those dates before we start the
interview. We'll talk about that. That's great. So let's talk about Broadway.
Broadway.
Susie, you spearheaded this issue. Tell us a little bit about what's in it. And there's a lot online as well, but talk about what's in the print issue first.
The print issue is, you know, headed by, I guess we'll go with our cover image first, the gorgeous picture of Cynthia Nixon and Laura Linney, who are switching off in the roles of Regina and Birdie in the revival of Lillian Hellman's Little Foxes at Manhattan Theater Club. It's a fun interview. One of the things I learned reading that interview is that it was Laura Linney's idea that they switch roles. And I thought that was kind of fun because Laura had originally been cast as Regina, and then she remembered that Cynthia wanted to play Regina, so why not Cher? So it's a fun conversation, and the photos are gorgeous. And then we have a great critical essay by Garrett Eisler about the state of the new play, the new American play on Broadway, looking at how new plays have come to Broadway in the past and how new American writing gets there now. It's five great American playwrights are making their Broadway debuts this season, and we have a photo shoot with all five of them. Those playwrights are Lynn Nottage and Paula Vogel, two playwrights that many think should have made their Broadway debuts sooner than this season. And then there's J.T. Rogers, Joshua Harmon, and Lucas Naith. And so the essay explores kind of the history of the play on Broadway, how new plays are going this season. And then online, we actually have a fun conversation with all five of those playwrights that we did at the photo shoot day, kind of talking about, you know, the state of plays, the state of playwriting, what, you know, their plays on Broadway. So that's a little fun online exclusive. And then also in the issue, Celia Wren did a case study of three musicals that started at nonprofits across the country and how they kind of got to Broadway. We've written a lot in the past about the relationship between nonprofit institutions and Broadway. And, but this is looking very specifically at kind of the billing and the transfers and how kind of what the deals are that kind of bring shows from nonprofits to Broadway. And those shows that she looks at are Amelie, which was at Berkeley Rep and then Center Theater Group at the Amundsen Theater and is opening in Broadway this spring. Come From Away, which was at La Jolla and Seattle Rep.
Yeah, and a co-production with Fifth Avenue, I think.
With Fifth Avenue, and then it was also at Ford's Theater, and right. It had a commercial run in Toronto before it came to Broadway. And then she also looks at War Paint, which started at the Goodman. And then also in the issue, Rob Weinert Kent does a very fun interview and story on the composer Dave Malloy, who's Natasha Pierre in The Great Comet of 1812, is doing well on Broadway, I think. So it's a full issue in print and even fuller online,
even
which
will
take me
online.
A full hour to explain to you all the stories
yeah,
that are online.
List them all online.
There's a lot.
There's a lot of musical coverage online. In print, it favors a bit. Well, it's about split between the plays and musicals. But
yeah, there's two musicals in print and two plays in print.
But the thing to stress is
the features are plays.
All the features
stuff.
The big features. We're putting drama first. I mean, that's sort of the what Garrett's piece makes the point, and the nonprofit commercial piece makes the point as well. But his piece really strongly makes the point that that's the biggest change in the last 30 to 50 years, give or take, that new plays are still coming to Broadway, but the way they're either coming through development at the nonprofit houses, or they're being produced in the more recent development by nonprofits on Broadway. That would be Roundabout. Although Roundabout doesn't do new plays on Broadway. They help develop new plays, and then they sometimes go to Broadway. But Manhattan Theater Club, if you took out Manhattan Theater Club seasons, you would have a lot fewer new plays on Broadway.
At least a lot fewer new American risky plays.
And Lincoln Center. And then Second Stage is going to enter the Broadway game soon. So it's another piece about, in a way, the way in which commercial theater is no longer the place that new playwrights are nurtured, and it's not where they develop their work, with very few exceptions, unless you're a named playwright like David Mamet or Larry David or Neil Simon. The days of Neil Simon are over. Garrett's piece is a wonderful sort of, he makes a wonderful case. It's also just a wonderful bunch of tidbits and facts and bits of trivia. He spent a lot of time researching it. I think one of my favorites, when I tried to stump Howard Sherman with this recently, was which playwright has the most best play Tonys? Which living playwright?
Should we reveal it, or should you read Garrett's piece?
Good point. Well, let's just give you a hint. It's not, he's not American.
Oh, yeah. Which is another thing the piece is about kind of the British exchange of plays.
There's definitely some of that. I mean,
that's kind of supplanted American playwriting, new American playwriting, because there's always a British import coming in every season. And that could.
Well, actually, Garrett says that. I mean, Garrett makes the point that there's about two or three a season that are from Europe, whether it's Australian or English, and that it used to be much worse in the '60s. You couldn't get a best play Tony if you were American, practically. But it tends to be, basically, he breaks down an average season. There are more plays, new productions of plays on Broadway, revivals and of the shows that open that season. Now, that's this season, we don't think so. There's probably more musicals. We haven't done a full count. But in the average season, and that of those, about half of them are new plays. New defined not as world premieres necessarily, but, you know, making the Broadway premiere or fairly recent.
Yeah, not a revival.
Right, right. Yeah. And of those, about six or seven are new plays by American writers. So
Paula Vogel, in the Q&A that Susie did with the five playwrights, she was saying it's only five. Like, back in the day, there was like 30 to 40 new playwrights on Broadway.
Right. So, well, if you read Garrett's thing, I mean, he did the research. I mean, I don't want to contest Paula Vogel. He did the research. It shows that for the last decade, it's held steady more or less at about 40.
Paula was saying 30 years ago, there were a lot more.
And that's about when I think. Yeah. I mean, he goes through the economics of it too, the reasons why, how Broadway got defined by the seat number, how Tony eligible theaters have been defined. It hasn't always been even just Broadway. In fact, there was one piece of trivia in there is that Three Penny Opera, the off Broadway production of Theatre de Lise, got Tonys. I don't know how that happened. But anyway, that was so.
Well, there were also more Broadway theaters back then too.
There were more Broadway theaters back in the day. Anyway, it's a great piece.
Recommended.
We could relitigate the whole thing about it. But and then, of course, we were trying to theorize about there's probably more new musicals this season than there have been on Broadway for a long time.
Yeah, usually on Broadway there's about seven or eight new musicals, and there's five. I mean, the economics is, frankly, the Tony Awards consideration date, let's be real here, is the end of April. And mm-hmm. So just like movies open at the end of December for Oscar consideration, plays and musicals that really want the Tonys, like, try and open in March and April because I want to be fresh in voters' mind, blah, blah, blah. I have a lot of thoughts on that strategy. If I see 20 shows in 1 month, I don't remember any of them. I remember the show I saw in December. So producers, open your show in the fall or in January and February when it will stand out. This is my plea. But this is when they open. And usually there's a lot of shows opening in March and April, but usually there's, you know, seven or eight new musicals, and you can kind of guess who are going to get the five best musical Tony nominations. This year, there's got to be at least 13. And, like, it's anyone's race. And I know this isn't about the Tonys, but this is kind of a rarity to, like, look and be like, wow, we have five new American plays. Also, plays opening this spring by all players having the Broadway debut. That in itself is a new play category. But they're not the only new plays that open. There's, right. You know, The Present from Sydney and Oh Hello from the fall, which was wonderful. And, like, what are you going to do?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a...
I don't envy the Tony nominators.
Yeah, it's a busy season. So we that's our Broadway issue. We did one on television. We figured, why don't we do one about
Susie's favorite subject,
the theater.
Yeah, there's lots of good stuff online though, so check it out. It's a very big package.
It's a big package. One about conductors, wonderful piece about that. Also, I got to geek out with Sarna Lapine about her uncle's musical, Sunday in the Park with George.
That we've recommended on the show.
Yes, we did.
Last episode.
We did. And also in this issue, a wonderful piece about the Sneetches at Children's Theater of Minneapolis. So just plugging the issue. And Brandon Jacob Jenkins, the full text of his play, War, not coming to Broadway.
There's something we were talking about before we recorded about like how there seems to be no multi-year runs of plays anymore. Mm. And I'm wondering, because they're all limited engagement. So, Susie, I'm just wondering, like, is there like an economic reason for
well,
that?
They're not all limited engagement. I mean, Significant Other is open until it closes right now. And I don't know if A Doll's House Part 2 is limited engagement.
Well, Humans Broke Even and August Osage County some years ago
ran but
for
it only
a
ran
bit
for
of
like a year.
But that wasn't a limited engagement. That was just,
I mean, yeah, okay, so short-term runs.
Well, yeah, I think it's harder to get tourists to come to the place.
Yeah, if you go to the TKTS play line, there's your answer. I mean, it's plays, there's still an audience for them, but it's not a huge audience. And if there's not a name person in it or it's not a comedy show.
And if there's a name person in it, it usually make it a limited run. I mean, the talk about this, I mean, Todd Haynes has talked a lot about how he'll get a star to do a roundabout show because it's a limited run because roundabout's a subscription season even on Broadway. Yeah. But then kind of Scott Rudin kind of co-opted his model and just started doing limited runs commercially of plays with stars. And so, you know, they get a different paycheck if they do a Scott Rudin show versus if they do a roundabout show. And so,
well, you got the roundabout now with Mark Ruffalo and Danny DeVito and Tom
Schiller.
Oh, yeah,
no, roundabout still gets wonderful actors and stars.
Yeah, they do. But you can't put a new play on Broadway usually without a star.
Well, there's no star in Significant Other.
Hand to God.
That's true.
Now, I don't know if Hand to God broke
runs,
even,
yeah.
But Hand to God marketed it.
I think it did recoup.
Okay. Yeah. Well, great.
They did put Bob Saget in there for a while, though.
Okay.
That's demented.
So the appeal, yeah, it's easier to star playwright or star actor. I mean, Tracy Letts has a new play coming to Broadway next season. It'll be at Steppenwolf first and then comes direct to Broadway, but it's coming with the Chicago cast.
Linda Vista?
No, that's the opening next month. It's something about the election. I forget
what the
name
is. But this is part of what Garrett talks about is the size of the theater. It makes a big difference in terms of how many seats you can, you know, turn around. Also, the intimacy of plays, whether it's a play that can play. If Annie Baker went to Broadway, which house would she go into? Her plays rely on a certain amount of intimacy. I don't know if they'd be in a giant barn. A play like Clybourne Park was written in, that played really well on a sort of a big stage.
Right. But I saw like Venus and Fur a couple years ago, and that was a two-hander and small, like it was a really small set, but it still played
well. Yeah, that particular play plays to the back row. I was going to mention, when Second Stage goes, they're going to go in the Helen Hayes, which is a fairly small one. When I talked to Lynn Nottage some years ago, she's talking about, you know, Sweat making it to Broadway. By the way, Meet Vera Stark was doing really well at Second Stage. And it's the kind of thing that if they had another space, they could have just moved that show to Broadway and run it for at least a little longer, if not, you know.
Yeah. Well, isn't the Broadway house, Lincoln Center's Broadway house, also pretty small, too?
The Beaumont is
Not the Beaumont. But wait, is the Oslo running in the Beaumont?
Yeah, because Mitzi is off-Broadway.
The Mitzi is off-Broadway, technically.
Okay. Forget.
That's where the real estate of off-Broadway is hilarious. Downstairs is off-Broadway. Upstairs, I know it's the size of the house, but it's not even the same district as... Not even the same district as the other theaters.
Well, I mean, Second Stage is off-Broadway spaces in the middle of Midtown. It's right next to Broadway shows. Second Stage's theater.
Oh, right.
I know. They're getting the Helen Hayes, which will be their Broadway space. But they have a very nice theater on 43rd Street.
But if I opened a theater on the east side that was big enough and I was politically connected enough and was nonprofit, I could probably make that Broadway eligible, right?
It'd have to be Midtown East, right?
No, Lincoln Center's Center? Upper West Side.
Yeah.
It's like 66.
That's not Midtown.
That's true.
Lincoln Center's an outlier that we're happy to embrace into
but
the
Lincoln
Broadway.
So should we open our own Broadway house? It's only 500 seats.
But Lincoln Center sure. also, they possible. Rent...
The
Lincoln
American Center, Theater? We'll call Lincoln, it the American Theater. Oh my God, it's such a great idea.
Lincoln Center also rents out certain other houses when they have shows. Like, they do that. The Belasco is used by Lincoln Center a lot.
Oh, that's true.
Right. And like, when they run Disgraced, that was at the Belasco.
Yeah,
right?
And Roundabout owns the Sondheim, but rents that out to commercial producers sometimes. So Roundabout can use Sondheim. But, well, didn't they use it for Anything Goes? That was Roundabout.
They did do that. Mm-hmm. They did. Mm-hmm. I think they, whatever house makes sense for them, but they have a lot to choose from. I do note the irony of Sweat opening at Studio 54. That just feels crazy.
I keep thinking it's at the Friedman, and I'm wrong, because it's not MTC.
It's an MTC kind of show. Again, I support that show going to Broadway. I think she's a wonderful writer. It's long overdue. It's just when you think about the history of Studio 54, the decadent home of New York nightlife.
I mean, it is a bar play.
That's true. Actually, that space is, to take away the history of it, it is kind of a gritty, fairly intimate space in some ways.
There was another quote that I loved in Susie's story that I shared on Twitter. When Lynn Nottage said, "I'm not really surprised Sweat's going to Broadway. It has the least amount of black people in it of any play that I've ever written."
And it doesn't have one female heroine.
Yeah. It's not, it's not led by women of color. So.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, there's a certain demographic that is better for Broadway.
Right.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think about it that way, but I guess that has some truth. I mean, the timeliness of it being a play about the working class and the Rust Belt is probably not a lot.
But everyone thought Rune should have come to Broadway.
Yeah, Rune should have been on Broadway. That could have been a tough sell, but I think that should have been on Broadway.
I mean, they sold Eclipsed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can't have two plays,
Women in Africa. Right.
They would have been different seasons.
They would have been very far apart. You could have built on the success. Like, we want another one like that.
Exactly.
Anyway. Was it successful?
Eclipsed?
Was it? Did it break
even? How do you measure success?
Yeah. I think people saw it. I don't know.
Did it win Tonys?
Well,
we could talk about Broadway all day because we're just down the street from us. Let's talk about something that's not down the street from us, but has impact on theater in every congressional district in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the National Endowment for the Arts. As everyone knows, last week, President Donald Trump, words we love to say. I think that might be the first time we said that on the podcast, the full name.
You can just say the president.
Number 45.
The Republican president released a budget document. Now, all the caveats are useful here. These budget documents don't have a lot to do with the actual budget that gets passed.
They
almost never have.
It's more aspirational than anything else.
They are, as Kevin Drum and Mother Jones called it, in this case, it's like one long tweet. It's basically letting you know what his priorities are. And what is striking about it is that while, either slashing or even zeroing out the NEA has been something that congressional Republicans have talked about in their budgets and proposed, and it was pointed out, apparently it was something that Reagan wanted to do when he came in.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the history of that, that's before the NEA was even controversial. But he was won over and actually made in his administration, this is Reagan, it got to its highest level of funding. He became an arts advocate. But this is the first presidential budget that has put that on the block. The National Endowment for the Arts, National Endowment for the Humanities, and Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So that all those caveats out of the way, it's a chilling thing that a president has put it in his budget. I will say.
Well, he didn't want to see Come From Away, so I don't think he's really into the theater.
Did he say publicly he didn't want to see Come From Away?
Yeah, I think there's a Washington Post article about how, one of the leaked conversations is how they wanted him to go to Broadway show because that's kind of what happens. That's what presidents do.
Sure.
And they suggested Come From Away because it's about 9/11 and he did not want to go to see
it. But Ivanka saw it.
He was busy going to Andrew Jackson's grave, which is what I heard. He preferred to pay tribute to Andrew Jackson, another theater star.
Susie's face, I'm sorry.
Yeah. In any case.
Sorry, that just speaks for itself.
it does. It speaks volumes, right, that's his priority. Look.
The House still needs to, because it's only it's a budget document,
right,
it's a proposal,
right,
and that it still needs to go through committee, and it still needs to be approved in the Senate and the House.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of steps in between now and then.
Well, we could bracket whether we even think that the politics of this administration and Congress have anything to do with what might actually happen. Obviously, a lot of people are being hurt and will be hurt by various policies. I think that's our opinion of the administration. I don't know that anything in this budget, and it's worth mentioning that, A, these are tiny pieces of the budget, tiny, tiny pieces of the discretionary non-defense spending that he's trying to cut. Tiny, and there are so many other things being cut from this, which are so, you
Meals
know,
on it, wheels.
Right, which are so important. And, you know, the Meals on Wheels analogy is really good. Some people point out, like, he's not cutting all the Meals on Wheels. It's like, it's not the whole program. But the point is, like the NEA, the bit that Meals on Wheels gets from the government is hugely crucial, and it's then doubled and duplicated by philanthropy, which doesn't mean that you can take away the federal money. The federal money is like a seed money. It's like a brand, a stamp of approval.
And then money comes back from the arts.
In the arts, the case of the arts, less so Meals on Wheels. In the case of the arts, it's a huge economic driver. And I will say, gaming out the politics of this, you already saw stories about Republicans lining up to support the NEA. The case has been made for long enough, from the Reagan era to now, despite the huge, some of the first stories I wrote as a journalist were in the late 80s, early 90s about the NEA fights, those ridiculous culture war fights, the Pat Buchanan culture war crap. And as Tony Kushner, I think, recently pointed out, that was about gays and multiculturalism. That was what the NEA fights were about. If you leave aside that, which was a big deal, there's been a lot of Republican support for the things the NEA does, not just elite arts institutions, but arts therapy, funds that do access, arts education.
Free theater tickets, subsidized theater tickets.
Exactly.
Shakespeare in the Park is funded by the NEA. So it's like any
and
of the...
Bank of America.
And Bank of America.
Right.
So, yeah, but it's like matching... Like, do you think Bank of America would fund the entire Shakespeare in the Park?
Maybe.
But it seems to me like it's one of those things that it's not going to affect big institutions as much as it affects like smaller institutions in smaller cities whose grant budgets are bigger and where $10,000 from the NEA can go a longer way in those cities.
Right. And state arts councils. I think 40%, almost half of NEA's money goes to state arts councils to distribute as they will.
I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. Like we've said, it's going to take a while for approval, but like it's also going to pull into action a lot of private donors. I mean, like the
right.
But that's, you know, private donors are there are going to be some lucky communities that have access to private donors and some that don't.
Right. It's true. No, the NEA has a powerful purview over these districts and areas where the arts are not as well serviced, and I think if there's private money that goes to these underserviced areas, it's because the NEA has drawn attention to them.
It's like anything the government funds. You know, the government funds science.
Right.
Yeah.
And no, exactly. Yeah. And there's public-private partnerships there as well. That's a great model for that. Teresa Eyring wrote a wonderful piece, which I should look up from about a month ago, responding to criticisms of the NEA, which I think lays out the case extremely well for the NEA. The other thing that drives me really crazy, but you know, a lot of this drives us all crazy, but is the assumption that art is for the elite, as if people, average people don't deserve art, can't understand art, and as if artists themselves aren't average people, working class people who deserve money and are trying to make ends meet. I don't like where the discussion immediately goes to like carpooling liberals not getting their NPR and their symphony tickets. It's an easy caricature, which I of course reject.
Well, there was didn't someone say like how can you ask, you know, a single mom to pay for Sesame Street and NPR, and then it's like, but it that makes it free for them. Like that's why we need to. That's why the government pays for it.
She
to make
does
it accessible.
Pay for it. It's
she
part
does.
Of her taxes.
Exactly. Well, and her kids also use it.
Well, first of all, a lot of people in this, depending on the tax bracket, don't have a tax liability, so they're not really paying for it. But B, as John Oliver, I think, joked, like, I'm sorry, Sesame Street is a lifesaver for a single mom.
Exactly.
So, you know, that it's a silly debate. I actually have some confidence that the arts and public broadcasting, despite what I just said about them not being elite institutions, they have enough support from conservative, middle-of-the-road people. I'm not as worried about them. I'm worried about the rest of the, you know, or social safety net, and
I'm worried about the EPA
and the Republic. that we live in.
But in the meantime...
Well, sure, the APA, yeah, there's that.
But in the meantime, I just discovered this thing called ResistBot, where if you text a certain number, then they'll ask you for your address, and then they ask you what you want to say to your representatives, House and Senate, mm-hmm. and then they'll automatically fax your statement to the representative because apparently...
Wow.
Yeah.
Fax?
Yeah, they fax it because according
phone
to...
Phone lines are always tied up.
Yeah, phone lines are always tied up, and the staffers don't always read emails.
I haven't heard the word fax for so long.
Oh, I used to work at a newspaper where our arts critic would fax in his photos for a story, and then he would call me and dictate his column to me.
Fax photos?
Yeah.
Why would you...
I don't even
the quality
understand
ship
that.
Then, like, how you can't even
oh, we
run
didn't
that.
Use them.
Okay.
Oh, I see. Just to see what they were. And
yeah,
just
so
the
I could see it as he dictated his column to me. I could see the photos.
But yeah, guys. So if you want to pressure your congresspeople about the NEA and Sesame Street and the EPA.
Or about anything. Yeah.
Or about anything.
Right.
Try ResistBot. It's very convenient. I do it on the subway. It's awesome.
Well, I hope that works. Why don't we go to our interview with Martine, and then we'll come back and do some recommendations.
Right. Oh, and I should note three things. On the Exhale is running until April 2nd at the Roundabout. Seven Spots in the Sun, which is about a civil war in Latin America. It's running at Rouse from April 26th to June 4th. And also, the sound quality is a bit shoddy because I recorded it. I was supposed to record it in this office, but I had to record it at home because we had a blizzard. And so...
Remember that.
So the connection goes in and out a little bit.
Okay.
FYI, so sound people, please do not email us telling us that the sound is shit. I know it is.
All right.
So are you doing any work on this this production or this play?
I never rule out the idea that I might rewrite something. I don't anticipate doing a ton. It's been a workshop so many times, and this will be number four. So it will be obviously it's his first in New York. I think it's his first anywhere on the East Coast. I don't anticipate doing a ton of rewriting. I'm sure I will be open to doing, I'm always open to rewriting, but I have workshopped it so many times that I don't know that I can do any more at this point.
Is this your New York debut?
On the XL, my New York debut.
Yeah, yeah. So like, usually when buddies come to New York, they're usually a little bit, oh my God, I need to redo things, make sure that, you know... The Times Critic loves it, but it seems like you're very relaxed about this whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also due to a lot of things. I think it's due also to the fact that I don't only work in theater, and I think that in a healthy way, I think when you work in both TV and theater, it allows you to sort of step outside of the box of each industry and step into a world where it's clear that the stakes are lower in a way. That mm-hmm. like, oh, there's a whole world in TV where, yes, some people care about theater, but a lot of people actually don't. And I feel like it's healthy. No, it's really healthy. And I think similarly, when you step into the theater world to realize like, oh, there's a whole world where people don't care about like what's going on in Hollywood right now. And I think that's just really healthy to have that perspective. And I think it reminds me that the point of writing plays is to write the kind of play that I want to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just takes the edge and the heat off of the sort of worrying about what critics will think and allows me to stay true to what I want to do. And if I feel strongly that the play is reaching people and is saying what I want to say and communicating what I want it to communicate and that people are responding to it, that's what matters to me. So what matters to me is what's happening in the room. If I can feel how the audience responds and they're responding in a way that I feel like is productive, that's what matters most to me.
Oh, who do you write for?
I wrote for season one of Narcos, and then my current gig is on a show called Ozark on Netflix. We're on hiatus, sort of waiting to hear about when we would start a season two right now. So they just finished filming season one, and it will come out. It's a Netflix show. It will come out, I think, sometime this summer or fall. It has Jason Bateman and Laura, the two sort of lead roles, I guess, for lack of a better word. Because there are obviously many roles, but they're sort of the headliners of the show. And it's about money laundering in the Missouri Ozarks. It's a very fascinating topic and a very fascinating world. So yeah, so that's the show that I'm on right now.
So back to theater, you're talking how writing for TV, it takes a pressure off of being a playwright. Out of like wondering what people think of your plays, was that an organic thing you came to, or was it, is it just something, what happens when you divide your time between TV and theater?
I think it's this sort of, I think it's something I just realized when working on my first TV gig, when I was sitting there thinking, oh, like, there's a whole world where people don't care about theater. And I don't mean that in a like bad, dismissive way. I actually find that wonderful. I find it wonderful to go to a place, a world, a workplace where nobody knows what I do or seems to care. I know a lot of people seem disheartened by that, and they're like, oh, but these people don't care about what we're doing. And obviously, I think more and more we should be trying to reach a wider and wider audience with theater. But I also just think it's really healthy to like step into a subset of society where people aren't wrapped up in the sort of quotidian concerns that you have as a theater maker. I think it's really wonderful. I think it helps ground our perspective. And I also think it's such a challenge for us as theater artists to think, okay, well, what kind of theater can we make that appeals to these people? Because I think increasingly, unfortunately, theater or a small subset of people who are really invested in theater and bless them for being so invested in theater because they're keeping theater alive. But I think it's a wonderful challenge to me to think, okay, well, what kind of play could I write that would get that person who doesn't think about theater at all to come into a theater? The thought of like, oh, theater doesn't enter their mind at all in a given day. I find that a wonderful challenge. And I think it's something that we all have to do. And I think it's essential if we're going to keep theater relevant. So I actually love encountering people who don't think about theater, who don't go to theater.
As a creative person, you don't set out to say, I want these people to come to my plays, but as you've been writing, have you discovered some ways to attract people who don't normally come to the theater?
Yeah. I think I try and put it sort of in the aesthetic of what I write. I mean, my stuff tends to be pretty character driven and pretty, pretty narrative. I don't want to say that that's the only way to write or it's the only way I will write forever, but it just seems to be the way that I know that I can draw people in. I also really, really, really firmly believe that when I'm writing a piece of theater, it has to be theatrical and it has to be trying to make use of what only theater can do so that people come in and maybe they're not used to seeing theater and they think, wow, I could only have seen that story or that kind of storytelling live and in person. I feel like, unfortunately, because it's not true of other media, but I feel like theater is at a point where every piece of theater needs to be making a case about why theater is essential. And yeah. So it's fun to me when I see plays that aren't making a case, that aren't you know exploiting the unique advantages of what theater has to offer, because I feel like we as an art form need to be, every person who comes into a theater, we need to be convincing them that this art form is essential.
Right, definitely. But that's my kind of favorite theater too, things that tie into the wider world that we live in. And it like ties into like how we live our lives. And that's why I really liked to, when I saw On the Exhale, it was touching on something that I think we're all grappling with, which is gun violence. And then in the New York Times article that you were quoted in, it seems like a newer thing that theater people are grappling with. And I'm just like, why are you waiting until now to grapple with it?
Yeah. And I also think that, hopefully, I think what that play is also doing is that it cannot exist without the audience. That it is so, her connection to the people actually in the room with her is vital to make that play work. That hopefully the play is happening as much in their head as it is happening on stage. And people describe, a lot of people narrate their experience of the play, and aided by Marin's beautiful performance and Lee's direction and the lights, but also Rachel Hauk's beautiful set as allowing them to imagine so vividly the story she's telling that they, mm-hmm. there are moments where they sort of come to and forget that there's actually only one person on stage, and then they sort of, oh, there's only one person here. So I really love that kind of, it feels really private and intimate, and it feels like it's happening as much in their head as it is on that stage. And I feel like all the plays that I write try and do that in different ways. Seven Spots on the Sun is obviously a very different play. It's a much larger play. It's a physical play. It's a play about a community, but it's also a play about what it means to bear witness. What does it mean to witness crimes, and does that obligate you then to act, to help people? If you see something, are you obligated to help that person, even if acting could put your own life at risk? And so hopefully that will, the audience being essential in that will also come across, because they're witnessing something and then also being asked to interrogate what it means to witness something. So they're sitting here with people live and in space observing something and then asked to interrogate what it means to observe something. And hopefully, it will make them think about what their role is, in a repressive society. See something on the street. How are they obligated to intervene?
Right. Like those questions of like, do we speak up when we see something really horrible going on? I feel like that's a theme of our lives right now.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And it wasn't necessarily that I thought that would be the case in the U.S. I mean, I think it's always the case in any country. I think we all encounter things that we could say something about on a daily basis and choose not to. But I think that would become such a huge – that it would – no longer be subtextual, but so explicit in U.S. society. I couldn't have imagined that when I wrote the play. And part of me is sad the play is so clearly relevant to people now in the U.S., but I'm also, I guess I'm glad that it feels like something I've written can speak to people and can speak to a particular moment. I find that not with Seven Spots on the Sun, but with other plays of mine too, that people have written me since the election and said, oh, can I pitch this play to this theater? I just feel like I've been thinking about this play a lot since the election, and suddenly it feels so much more right now, which is really sad to me.
But as a creator, you want your things to hold up over time and outside of the time it was written in, right?
Oh, of course you do. But then to think that it's relevant means that, a lot of the things I write about are about a lot of intense suffering. And so to think that it speaks to people means that people are perhaps having similar experiences. So I don't know. In a way, I think there are a lot of writers I know and a lot of writers I respect hope that their work would seem obsolete. And I have expressed that they're like, oh, I'm sad that my work continues to be relevant and that we haven't moved past some of the things that I've written about.
So why suffering? What is it about this theme that kind of makes you want to keep revisiting it?
Oh, I guess as a political writer, I feel like it is an obligation to speak about injustice, and injustice breeds suffering. And so I think that, hopefully it is my writing is a way of helping people sort of move through and work to how we can fight injustice in different ways. It's not polemical, it's not an essay, but it is thinking theatrically about how we can examine our role as an audience and as spectators in injustice that happens around us.
Right. So I just wanted to go, like, give the audience, like, an introduction to each of the two plays.
Yeah.
And I want to start with On the Exhale, just because it's running right now. Tell me, so On the Exhale, you're not a parent, but it seems like you were really inspired by Sandy Hook and the violence at Sandy Hook. And so what was it about that topic that made you want to write a play?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the seed of the play was that sort of like rage that I felt. And I also knew that, I've long been fascinated with the sort of what I think is the paradox of what it means to fire a weapon and how you're operating this machine. And yet in order to operate it effectively, you need to be so calm. And a lot of people who are really good shooters talk about how meditative it is. People talk about the act of hunting as being really a sort of meditative experience and embracing that stillness. So I've been fascinated by that. And so I knew pretty early on, once I got the seed of the play, that it would be about one woman, and that what would I'm very invested in how a form of storytelling is inextricably bound with what the story is about, and this I knew that it was going to be a story about grief and the solitude of grief, how that isolates a person, and then also the sort of solitude of firing a weapon, and how meditative and restorative in a way that solitude can be to people. And so I was interested in interrogating that paradox and the relationship between the solitude of grief and the solitude of firing a weapon. So I knew it was going to be a one-woman play pretty early on, but I was fortunate to have sort of between getting the seed of the play and when I actually sat down to write it, I worked on the first season of Narcos. So I had that time to let it gestate in my subconscious and really let my subconscious work through it before I sat down to write it in earnest. And then really when it became – the process of writing that first draft became about – since I knew this woman was going to make such a big journey from being a firearm to being a woman who was obsessed with a firearm, the writing of the play then really became about how to move her from moment to moment. How does she get from this tiny point to the next tiny point to the next tiny point? Because it's the only way you can earn that really big journey that she ends up taking.
Right. Well, what's so fascinating about it is like you kind of got into the mind of people who own guns and why they love them so much. And so I'm wondering, in order to further this conversation in a productive way that leads to action, is that something we all need to do, is trying to figure out the appeal of these things and speak to that?
I mean, it's really interesting. I feel like we have to. I think there are a lot of things that have to happen. I think that one of the biggest things that to me is so discouraging about gun control is the fact that so many members of the NRA don't agree with the stances that the NRA takes. And so I think one of the big things that has to happen in order for there to be gun control is that we need to control the influence of money in politics. I think it's unfortunately tied up in capital that like the gun lobby is really a corporate lobby, and it's not advocating for the desires of gun owners. I read yesterday that now there's a bill introduced in the Senate that is going to try pull back restrictions on buying gun silencers that have been in place since 1934. And the reason that the gun lobby is using for this is that they're saying that they're really concerned about protecting the hearing of gun owners. But, I mean, if you're operating a weapon, you can also use earmuffs, as she talks about it. It's so absurd to me that it sounds so absurd to even say it, that, like, oh, a silencer, which is actually used to conceal the fact that you are committing a violent act, but they're going to say that it's actually really important to protect gun owners' hearing. But it's like, oh, well, they can sell the gun lobby and gun manufacturers are able to sell pretty much every weapon under the sun, so what can't they sell? Well, they can make more money if now they can convince people to buy silencers too. So I feel like one of the big things we have to figure out is is the insidious influence of capital and money in politics. I also think that we need to be able to understand the emotional connection a lot of gun owners have to these weapons. I think that there is a real intense emotional connection. There are a lot of people who own firearms who are really passionate in their advocacy for their right to own firearms, and they don't passionately advocate for other things that are more essential to their well-being and their quality of life. So I think that thinking about that, like, oh, if there's a person out there who's more concerned with their ability to own a firearm than they are perhaps concerned with their ability to have health insurance, or more concerned with having a minimum wage that's a living wage, then they're less concerned with that, with having a minimum wage as a living wage, than they are with their ability to own a firearm. Like, there obviously must be some really intense emotional connection to this machine. And so I think that we have to, I think this play and is an attempt to also understand that, because I don't think that we're going to have effective gun control in this country if we also can't understand, like, why is it that people are so attached to these machines? What's behind that? And how do we address that emotional bond? How do we have gun control? And also sort of get around the fear that people have about being separated from their weapons.
Yeah, yeah.
How do we deal with that?
Yeah, because you're just talking about, and I remember this other bill that was, I think it was an amendment to the bill, or they're rolling back restrictions on people with who are mentally ill, or have a history of mental illness. They can now buy guns.
It's also, I think that, like, there isn't, you know, the attempt to pull back restrictions on people who are guilty of domestic abuse. Mm-hmm. You know, that those people can access firearms is deeply, deeply disturbing, because so much of the gun violence is actually, you know, men killing their girlfriends or spouses.
Right, right.
And it becomes so easy to do that when there's a firearm in the house.
Just follow the money. Follow the money. Yeah. And Seven Spots in the Sun, it's been around for a couple of years now, but for our listeners who haven't seen it, can you tell me a little bit about how that started?
Yeah, my mother is from Argentina, and so I got a grant. It was actually about a decade ago now that I went to do. I interviewed a lot of, this is in 2007. Argentina had a dictatorship that disappeared tens of thousands of its citizens. And shortly after the dictatorship ended and there was a return to democracy, there was a sort of blanket pardon law passed, pardoning anyone who had committed, you know, mainly people who committed acts of political violence on behalf of the government. And then in 2003, I believe it was, the Supreme Court overturned that law, which then allowed people to begin to be prosecuted for crimes they'd committed decades before. And so I was really interested in understanding how this sort of justice process delayed impacted victims and the families of victims, how it impacted their perception about whether there had been justice, about their ability to sort of process what had happened to them, and I don't want to say move on, but how it affected their ability to live in the present, knowing that there had been no justice for so long, but that there was beginning to be justice. Is justice delayed the same thing as justice denied, basically? And interviewing people about that. So I took a trip. I was there for about 6 weeks interviewing tons of people at, and so this play, while Seven Spots in the Sun is set in an unnamed country, I think that was important for me so that it wasn't, it could speak to these characters and the emotional truth of their relationships more than being about trying to represent the specificity of an individual country's history, because, you know, even today, but throughout the second half of the there have been a lot of similar violent struggles, violent conflicts happening in Latin America, and a lot of civil wars happening. And so I didn't want the play to be about trying to factually represent the history of what happened in an individual country as much it was about, as much as it, I wanted it to be about the truth of what it means about when you don't receive any kind of justice, can you heal? Can you mourn? Can you forgive people? Can you move on? Is justice delayed, justice denied? And I wanted a play that would sort of speak to the epic scale of devastation people often feel in the aftermath of these civil wars. And so to me, that it is a magical realist play. And to me, why the sort of magic makes sense and why it's there is that for a lot of people who live through these civil wars, not just in Latin America, but in a lot of other parts of the world, the scale of the devastation and the way in which their lives are completely destroyed so quickly feels, it can feel like magic, what's happened. It can almost not feel real. It's almost impossible to sort of process the reality of what's happened. So hopefully to me, the magical elements of that play help us understand the psychological state of the people who've had to live through these circumstances.
Right. And then like the question of justice and the question of whether justice denied and versus justice delayed and what happens when you don't get justice. I feel like that's also a question that we're also grappling with right now in terms of the violence against the Black community and also all of the people who, you know, don't get tried for raping innocent people.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think your fascination comes from with these big societal moral questions rather than writing a domestic drama?
Yeah, I don't know. Like even when I write like a play that's about sort of intimate familial relationships, I think it has to speak to these larger things. I don't know. I guess that's a really good question because I don't know where it comes from. It just feels like it's true to who I am, that I feel like I can't write a play unless it feels like it's speaking to something urgent. I don't know how to do that. And it feels like a waste of my time in a way. I don't know. I feel like that's the point of, I feel like that's also what working in TV has allowed me to do, is to sort of say, if I'm going to write a play, I don't necessarily need this thing. I can't, you know, I don't need to depend on this thing to make a living or a full living, I should say. So I better make it count from the point of like, it better be telling a story that matters and it better be speaking to something that matters and it better be true to who I am. Otherwise there's no point in doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to wrap up this conversation because we're talking so many things that are swirling around politically. And I feel like a lot of people are asking, what can theater do right now? And then this very divisive time that we're having. So what do you think is a function of this art form when everything is in such turmoil?
A great question, because I feel like theater can do a lot of things, but I feel like I think it's also important for theater artists to reckon with like what theater cannot do, and at a certain point think, okay, play about this right now, because the scale, the timeline on a play and what it takes to make a really interesting, meaningful play is relatively long, and I feel like there are a lot of moments, especially after the election, where I'm sitting here thinking, no, we shouldn't be thinking about how we can make a play about this. We should just be protesting in the streets. So I think it's like, what can theater do? I think theater can, the way theater can shape people is it can shape people's perceptions in small ways. It can sort of force small awakenings to happen. And sometimes it can sort of shift people's perceptions really radically in a wonderful way. But I think that, I think it's important to think that like theater, the way theater impacts people is sort of subtly in the long term, rather than you're not going to put on a play that's going to change everyone's mind immediately right now. I feel like it's important to acknowledge that like some theater in the short term. Not that we shouldn't do theater, but that like, oh, okay, what we need to do right now is urgently, we need to be activists and not artists. We need to be protesting. We need to be, you know, when a travel ban is passed, we need to be at that airport, passionately advocating to make sure that people are not being held in detention. So I think it's important to ask as much what theater can do, because there are a lot of theater artists who are asking that question. It's important to ask, you know, when should we not be relying on theater in a particular moment and actually be relying on putting our bodies in public space and being relying in different ways sort of to gain awareness rather than putting on a play in a conventional theatrical space. Maybe also what theater can do is thinking about, like, what sort of strategies that we use in theater can we be using in public protests? What sort of theatrical devices can we be using? What organizational devices? How can we as theater makers, what are the skills that we use to organize in theater that we can use to organize in protest?
Right, right. If there's one thing theater can do is bringing people together in large groups.
Exactly, exactly. And being conscious of how to put bodies in space in order to achieve certain objectives. And so some of those skills can be used in the service of a public protest and civil disobedience.
I love what you said about the cumulative effect of seeing theater, because it's completely right. You don't change your mind in one moment. You do it over a long period of time. You become more woke over time.
Exactly. And the way that sort of like that theater, you know, the way that issues of representation in theater work is slowly and over time, right? I think that's part of the sort of the thing that people have a hard time grappling with and sort of understanding how issues of representation work in plays they're working on, is they think, oh, what, like, I'm, you know, this is just one thing, but it's the snowball effect of issues of representation in a series of works over time that has an impact. And so I think it, similarly, right, we have to think about, like, plays being in conversation with each other and supporting each other in speaking to relevant and vital issues that, you know, it can't just be one play. It has to be, you know, play after play after play has to speak to meaningful issues, and we have to sort of celebrate them all, because that's how we shape people's perceptions. People are exposed to a critical mass of stories that are speaking to vital issues and speaking to issues of justice and being responsible in how they deal with issues of representation.
Right, right. And it's like, I was just on a diversity panel the other week, and something that came up, someone asked me, was, what should they do if a theater season has gender parity, but it's not racially diverse? And then, so what I said was, there's no goal in terms of diversity. It's not a thing you do one time. It's a thing you do consistently over time, and you get more and more diverse and varied as you go, technically. But it's not something, there's no, like, you don't get a prize for winning the diversity game.
And I think that we're trained in our education system to think, like, to think, okay, well, I'm going to do it right. Like, I'm going to do the thing, I'm going to check a box that then can allow me to not feel bad about myself or allow me to not have to think because I'm tired of thinking. And I think that when you deal with issues of representation and diversity, it has to, you have to remember that you always have to think. Mm-hmm. There's no easy answer. There's no, like, one simple choice that will allow you to then never have to think again or have to, or absolve yourself from having to think about your culpability or your the role you play in storytelling and in creating sort of responsible representation in your work. You have to think every single time very carefully.
Yeah, it's like the game never ends. So it was great talking to you. Thank you so much, Martine.
Thank you very much.
All right, and we're back, and we have things to talk about that we want to recommend, things we've seen, read, heard. Deep, what do you have?
Well, I'm a podcast junkie, so in addition to doing this podcast, I listen to a lot of podcasts on my commute. And one of the ones that I recently discovered, it's called Bad With Money, and it's hosted by a comedian named Gabby Dunn. And she's really bad with money. Like, at some point, she talks about how she only has, like, $20 in her bank account. And so she has people on her podcast to give her advice about being better with money and also to share their own stories.
Cool.
And
what is the theater connection to this podcast?
And I will get to it. She interviews a lot of artists.
Yeah.
And in one episode in particular, she interviews an actress named Stephanie Beatrice, who's on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, but she's actually started out doing children's theater at Theater Works and then did a couple of seasons at OSF.
So
she was a regional theater actor, and she talks about how the pay was so horrible, that's why she moved to television.
Yeah, yeah. She's a Brooklyn Nine-Nine, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is totally different, but Chrissy Metz, who's from This Is Us, wrote a really great op-ed, I think it was for Glamour, it might have been Refinery 29, about how she, like, used to have, like, $20 in her bank account, and it was, like, really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Beatrice is talking about, like the her first television paycheck was $7,000, and she was like, oh my god, I'm rich.
Wow, I'm gonna listen to this podcast.
better about myself, because usually we always feel very bad about being poor and not knowing how to handle our finances, and this just takes some of the shame away.
Guys, so, if you ever need to be good at handling your finances, work with Deep. She is so good at saving money. Shame you if you spend $10.
Because Deep has a fear of making large purchases because she always fears that she's going to be poor and lose all of her money. So she just gets really nervous. She just never spends a lot of money on anything.
Yeah, if I want to make a frivolous purchase, I always run it by Deep. Mm-hmm. Like this phone case. She said it was okay.
Yeah.
So what do you have to recommend besides the phone case?
By the way, the phone case says, nevertheless, she persisted.
It's very nice. It was on sale.
It was on sale.
I don't recommend paying full price for anything, yes, including theater.
And Deep said it was frivolous, but it was okay because it was on sale. Anyway, I'm gonna switch gears and recommend. We love talking about personal finance at this office. I'm going to recommend Stephen Levinson's new show, If I Forget, which is playing at Roundabout Off-Broadway. Right, yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. It felt very, it's a Holocaust play, but it's a bit of like, that's generalizing too far. It's really a family drama. And if you've listened to this podcast at all, you know me, I love my living room family drama. Mm-hmm. And so, but it's got a great cast. It's got Kate Walsh, Maria Dizia, Jeremy Shamos. They're all wonderful in it.
Only one of them is a Jew, but that's okay.
Okay. Which one?
I think Jeremy Shamos, actually. I looked it up.
Yeah, it's about these siblings who basically come home to their childhood home. Their father's, ailing, and Jeremy Shamos' character is a professor, and he's written this book about how, the Holocaust is kind of ruined modern day Judaism, and and his siblings are going through similar crises, and he has a daughter who's on her birthright trip in Israel, and she's got some mental health issues, and he's worried because it's set in 2000 and 2001 when there's always political struggle in that region, but there was specific difficulty during that time. Anyway, I really enjoyed it. It was moves really well, great cast, great play. I could see it moving to Broadway.
Stephen Levinson, man.
Yeah.
Killing it.
I will admit, I like Stephen Levinson a lot, and I think his book for Dear Evan Hansen is one of the greatest musical books ever.
Oh, he wrote the book for Dear Evan Hansen?
Yeah.
Only original book for a musical since, like, Book of Mormon.
It's yeah.
I feel like we should feature him or something.
Yeah, well, yeah. He's really emerged as a writer this season, I feel like. I've seen his earlier work, which I've liked, but it's never, like, really stood out to me the way that he's standing out this season. So.
I have not seen his work until these, but I know that...
You didn't see Language of Trees or Unavoidable Disappearance of Tom Dernan?
Nope.
7 Minutes in Heaven?
Those plays didn't get quite the critical acclaim that these...
I will admit I didn't see 7 Minutes in Heaven, but it was the first play at one of my favorite New York theater companies, Colt Kerr, that they did. And their work, they did Dryland, which we published. And so, yeah. No, anyway, I really recommend If I Forget.
Well, if you forget, it's maybe coming to your theater near you, right?
Hopefully.
Hopefully. I'm going to quickly recommend another wonderful, very well-made play, old-fashioned kind of play at the Public called Gently Down the Stream. It's by Martin Sherman, who's best known for the play Bent. And this play stars Harvey Fierstein and Gabriel Ebert. And it's a lovely intergenerational play about gay culture and what is sort of lost and what is gained by the changes, gay marriage, civil marriage. It takes place in London, so which is where Martin Sherman is. But Harvey Fierstein plays a not that convincingly Southern kind of Jim O'Quinn figure, a pianist from New Orleans, who has a bunch of monologues, wonderful monologues about his life as a gay man in the '60s, '70s. From the closet on, and it's really it's kind of just a great Harvey Fierstein showcase, but it's a well-written, lovely play. It kind of goes to expected places but in unexpected ways, so I highly recommend that one. And I'll be talking to Martin Sherman and the director Sean Mathias for American Theater, though that post won't be up in time for this podcast, so look for that.
On that close note, close out
yes.
Why are you looking at me? I'm not on it.
Okay, so yes, well, links to all the things we talked about will be on our show page. Check out all the exciting stuff online going on at American Theater.
all the Broadway
like
stories.
Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter.
Yeah, guys, we reached 100,000 likes on Facebook, but we can always use more.
We can always use more. More love. Spread the love.
And you can find us on iTunes. Review us there or on Google Play or Stitcher.
Cool. Till then, see you at the theater.